And I'm Fast Eddie.
And I'm Digital Dave.
And we're here with Captain Richard Dan. He's filling in for Captain...
He's a recurring guest.
He is a recurring guest.
He gets the center square.
And a great guest he is, too. We've had a good time with Captain Dan. All at his expense, of course.
All at his expense. He's been very gracious.
And here's Captain Mark Hubbard now. And we'll get him set up.
Get him set down. Set up, sit down, whatever.
Alrighty then, I'm here. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, sir.
Mother. Nice to meet you. I heard that. He called him Mother.
Mother. Well, it's right there on his flight suit. It says
actually,
Mother.
It is.
Most people get it. Last name Hubbard.
Yeah, actually, I was Mother. A little slow. I didn't pick up on it right away.
It's one of those days, you know.
Very good.
Well, what we're going to talk about today, according to what I saw on our schedule, is the life of a carrier pilot.
Oh, that's good living. I'm telling you, I'll tell you one thing for sure. It reminds me of the good living on the carrier is the traffic this morning. It's one thing you don't have to worry about on the carrier.
Yeah, that's true.
It is a short commute from your, I guess you'd say your cabin to the aircraft.
Oh, yeah, your at-sea cabin. You're about 1,000 feet from everything you need, except one very important element, your family.
That's exactly right. Speaking of life on board an aircraft carrying your family, what kind of communications do you have with the family at home?
Well, I'll tell you, over the 27 years of my Navy career, it's evolved immensely. It started out with just writing letters. And we'd set out with good intent to write a letter every day for that 180 possibly 210-day deployment.
And you could tell the ones that were coming off deployment, their hand was all cramped up.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I was pretty good about it, as was my family, about returning those letters. And you'd number them. That way you'd make sure that everything fell into place and you got the sequence of events as they may have unfolded in your absence. And it was kind of funny. Sometimes you get letter, 10, 11, 12, 20, 30 before you got 1, 2. And so you find out that your young son was getting the stitches taken out or his cast taken off, and you didn't even really understand the accident. So
Yeah. You're
waiting for the events to unfold. Now, today it's instantaneous, as you might imagine, with communications, email, and satellite comms.
Comcast in the room.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. I had a sat phone in my room, fortunately, during my last deployment, and it was used by myself, my lieutenants, and all my sailors who needed to reach out to their families in urgent conditions, and had a lot of liberties with that. So today it's instantaneous with Facebook and emails.
That's nice.
Are you able to use Skype on board the carrier by any chance?
You know, that's the hard part. We don't, because we are kind of confined to using the local unclass net on the boat, and the boat will transmit those messages when the time and bandwidth are the provisions are made available. But Skype takes up a little bit too much bandwidth. And I haven't been, on a deployment in the last couple of years, so I don't think Skype is something we can use yet. That's something, it is a medium, though, that I'm sure that we're marching towards very quickly.
Well, I think that they probably have to evaluate all those things just for security concerns anyway.
Yeah, certainly.
So, well, we were talking to Captain Dan here. He was making a comment about his wash-and-wear flight suit here. And that's that's one of the things I've always wondered about. Here you've got an aircraft carrier with, about 5,000 crewmen aboard?
You bet.
And women?
Yeah, they're the 5,000, your closest friends.
Yeah, no kidding. That's quite a party.
That's a lot of rounds you got to buy.
What do you do for laundry facilities?
Well, it's pretty amazing. You just set this stuff out, and you put your colors in the colors, and your whites in your whites,
and it disappears and it comes back.
It disappears and it comes back. So every element of the ship, the ship's crew, air wing, the officers, the crew, they all have their own little pickup days. And we were fortunate enough in my last deployment that we had some executive washing machines, so guys like myself and Rich here could do our own laundry. And again, I pride myself in being able to be a servant leader and be able to do stuff for myself as what I would expect anybody to do things for me. So get out there and drop a knee and do your own laundry, it was kind of a good way for me to kind of relax but that's what I did. I usually did about 50% of my own laundry and some of the daily wear stuff I would throw into ship cycle. And you got to push a button of faith. A lot of guys, like I said, 5,000 trousers and shirts and socks getting washed a day, and things come back and maybe not looking the way you thought they should have looked, or
the buttons have been crushed by the dry cleaners.
Yeah, the buttons crushed the dry cleaners, then shot through your underwear to make holes. So and everything seems to come back the same color after a cruise. You really don't really matter much because you're just glad to be home. But
that brings up another question. Now, Navy has dress whites, and let me tell you
they don't go through ship's laundry, do they?
The uniforms look spectacular, and for the life of me, I just don't understand how they can stay that clean.
It's a brilliant question, too. We do have a pretty good dry cleaner, and the ship does pride themselves in getting things perfect and keeping the command and all the supporting entities within looking sharp. And that's I do have to say when it's time to dress up and we need to put our whites on and the sailors need to clean up and put their blues on as appropriate for rendering honors for dignitaries around the globe or maybe pulling into Pearl Harbor and looking at some of the amazing memorials and a testimony of the sacrifice the Americans have made around the globe to keep this country great and free. They know how to turn it on and make us look great. So I do put my whites into the system, and they came back looking brilliant. I mean, I'd say even better than out in town when I'm at home in Lemoore, California.
Nice.
Okay, now that we know way more about laundry than we ever wanted to know, let's talk about flying.
You bet.
Now, when you're on a deployment, obviously there's regularly scheduled missions, sorties, whatever you guys call them.
Sure.
But what about when you're not? Do you have to do proficiency every 90 days like a civilian pilot?
Well, when you're on deployment, typically when you're in theater doing the mission, proficiency is just a matter of the schedule officer getting the right guy in the right place at the right time to make sure that you maintain your night currency 1 and 7. If you did happen to fly out of a currency at night, yeah, you would have to do a day flight before you go at night, one day cat, one day trap. But typically when you're on station, night currencies aren't really hard to maintain. When you're transiting somewhere quickly and ship can't get into the wind because they're trying to maintain proposed intended movement or PIM, sometimes you can't stop. So guys do fall out of currency, so then it requires more touch and goes, more traps, more day stuff than night stuff. So it is quite challenging. But, you know, we have a schedule. It's called the FRTP, the Fleet Readiness Response Training Plan, and what it does is it's a cycle that we go through. It's a 27-month cycle, and it gives us a certain amount of money, a certain amount of resources, airplanes, people, parts, and things, and we train ourselves, and magically, when it gets ready to go on deployment, we're all ready to go, and then we maintain that battle rhythm throughout the transit getting on station, and then once we get on station, we maintain that battle rhythm by flying the right people at the right time.
Wow. You're flying the FA-18, I assume?
Yes, sir. Not what I started out in, but it's what I'm flying out in. I've been flying the Hornet since 1990.
What did you start out in?
A6 is the Mighty Intruder out of Whidbey Island.
Which was the last, stupid trivia, last side-by-side aircraft they flew.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And I tell you what, it's an amazing relationship you have with your bombardier navigator. Of course, back in the day when I flew the Mighty Intruder, it was, we're fighting the Cold War. So we're thinking about flying low under radar coverage. Sneaking in, putting our weapons on target on time, using technology is quite antiquated in comparison to what we know today. And we didn't have night vision goggles. And I lived and trained in the Cascade Mountains when you have thousands of feet of terrain above you and you're flying down in those valleys at night, a couple hundred foot at night. Total darkness, nothing to see looking outside the window, nothing to trust more than your BN who's giving you clearance out to 2 to 3 miles. And it's just an amazing...
Yeah, you do develop an amazing relationship there.
You bet.
Yeah. I'll bet you did a lot of sweating on those missions, too.
Yeah, and it was a fair amount of blood, sweat, and tears, I would say, planning and training and executing and a lot of satisfaction on the backside, knowing that we possess that potential to be able to fly that low, that fast, that deep into someone's backyard and to deliver munitions in accordance with national security.
Now, you've obviously flown combat missions.
Yes, sir.
And you're launching off a ship that could be hundreds of miles away from the target, much less the coastline.
Yes, sir.
You've got all these electronic navigational aids. Do you really get an appreciation for what they did in World War II where they had none of those navigational aids and they had to fly over water for long distances?
I'm very fortunate to say that I kind of do have a great appreciation for that, not only from reading about it and talking to my grandfather about it and many other veterans that I've been so blessed to meet and dialogue with over the years. I also have the rare distinct pleasure to fly with the Commemorative Air Force out of Camarillo, and I fly the Hellcat. And it's one of the airplanes that when I was a young man that my grandfather talked to me about as being one of the most significant, that and the Dauntless aircraft of the World War II, and something that I set my sights on, when I was growing up, that I want to fly a Hellcat. And of course, my father would remind me that the Hellcats have long since been taken out of the inventory and should set your sights on something more realistic. So I looked at the Phantom and I said, well, the Phantom's pretty cool. 1971, when I saw the Blue Angels that perform, I was 10 years old. I said, that's what I'm going to do when I'm going to grow up. And, of course, the day I got commissioned, the last active duty Phantom Squadron was decommissioned. I said, well, I better get moving here because all of my favorite airplanes that I've wanted to fly have quickly gone out of commission. But worked my way through all the training airplanes, A6, and then all Type Model Series Hornets. And then most recently got involved in my own little aviation, flying a Cub and
Your small airplane fix, as
I've
heard
it
called.
Yeah, exactly. Your aircraft adrenaline fix, and worked my way through, all the way up to flying the Hellcat now, and getting that out in front of America, and talking about the tribute and the contribution that airplane made in its time in service. So, sitting in that airplane, looking at the technology I have at my fingertips, getting back to your question, it's just amazing. I can't imagine flying over the water without an INS. I can't even imagine flying my Bonanza without three GPSs that I have. Inertial navigation systems, what we started out with in the A6, and now we've evolved to ring laser gyro GPSs, and just an amazing, precise navigation capability.
And if you look at the Hellcat and the Dauntless and all those airplanes, they had a place under the instrument panel where this about 15-inch by 15-inch
mo-board,
plotting
yeah.
board came out, and the pilot could plot.
Sure.
And that's how he made sure he was getting from place to place.
And in the Dauntless, they would teach their gunner in the back how to fly the airplane. That way the pilot could navigate from the front. And I've talked to a number of gunners that were in Dauntlesses during the war, and they said that after the war, they were as good as the pilots were flying the airplane, and several of them even logged a few landings, under a lot of scrutiny, I'm sure, of the pilot in the front that was coaching them along. But yeah, I mean, that literally it was, the whiz wheel, dead reckoning, a lot of just, pushing the I believe button and saying the carrier will be there.
Right.
We will have enough fuel. And just amazingly, they made their way. It's almost incomprehensible that you could do what they did in that period of time. And be so successful
and be accurate
and laser laser accurate.
Yep.
The Hellcat is one of my favorite aircraft, and you have a very unique standpoint between flying a state of the art World War II aircraft and now flying a state of the art Hornet. What appeals to you about the Hellcat?
Well, just its significance, and in the war, being the number one fighter, 19-1 kill ratio. We'll never enjoy that in any other airplane. Hopefully not.
Hopefully we won't need to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But with we lost 240 Hellcats during the course of the war and shot down over 5,000 Japanese fighters, and we you manufactured 12,000 of those airplanes, and there's only four or five of them left in the world that are flying today, which is pretty amazing in itself. And another thing that's so appealing is you really have to fly the airplane. And as a Hornet guy, a kid, if you knew me, I'm just a below average kid from Missouri that had a dream and wanted to fly for the Navy off the decks of our carriers. And to be able to compare that to what we did back in World War II and now fly an airplane where, frankly, I'm just a voting member. I get in there and I do know how to flip a few switches around, and basically interact with the airplane. Pilot vehicle interface is what I do. And the vehicle is really smart. It tells me, how I need to fly, where I need to fly. It won't allow me to do bad things to the airplane to hurt it. I'm just a voting member, exercising the mission that was planned, getting the weapons to a place where I can release them so they can fly themselves to the target, which is pretty amazing if you think about that.
Yeah.
And over the course of my 27 years of career, back in the day of A6s, we had to do a little bit more heavy lifting, I would say, in the sense of manual bombing. The weapons weren't as smart as they are today. They didn't have the little GPS guided fins to get them precisely on target. That we didn't have the precision capability that we have today. So we were able to maintain that precision with a lot of hard, heavy training. But we didn't. We don't have to work as hard today to get the weapons on target. And there's some advantages to that too.
Well, I'm sorry to have to cut you off.
We need to
go to break now, and I could talk with you for another couple of weeks, I think.
Definitely.
I want to thank you for joining us, sir.
Yes, sir.
And Captain Dan as well.
It's always a pleasure, guys.
Perennial favorite here, as they call him now, Captain Centennial.
Captain Centennial, that's pretty cool.
It's on my name tag.
Nice.
All right, this is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And this is Hot Start on EAA Radio.